This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for this program is Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft at the controls this morning. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. We're very happy. I am very happy to have here in the studio with me Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois and has been stopping by here on this program for a long time to talk about insects. And, you know, there, it just amazes me. We've been on the air now more than 30 years, and there are folks who have associations with the program that go back virtually to the very beginnings of the show. And Mae, we were talking, we had a little party yesterday, and Mae was here, and she said that she had figured that the first time she had been on was in 1982.
August 6, 1982.
So that would have been in the second year of the program being on. So that we'll call it 30 years.
And I counted them up. I may have missed a few, but at least 83 times.
83 times. It's amazing. And there are these folks who, you know, we couldn't scare them away. They did a show with us, and we asked them to come back, and they said sure. And they kept on coming back. So we're always happy to see them. And when we came to the point where we knew we were in the last days, we said, okay, we're rounding up our friends. There are some people we want to see one last time. And we asked Mae to be here, and she said, sure, she would come over. So
and
happy to have you here.
Oh, it's, well, two things. I was saying earlier to Harriet, on average, I come about four times a year. So that means I actually talk to you more often and regularly than I do with some family members. So, and the other thing is, I guess Martha Deal is associated with the show, referred to me as your Bette Midler.
Yes.
But I have to say, I won't be singing Wind Beneath Your Wings, but as an entomologist, I would have been singing Wind Beneath Your Elytra, because that would be more entomologically appropriate.
Yes, and of course, we wouldn't be nothing if not entomologically appropriate on this program. Well, and you and the other so many other people that we've had on the show have enabled us to, I hope, to pass on a lot of learning and knowledge and information about the world, and in a way that was fun and sort of light, so people didn't feel like they were in school. No quizzes. We'll follow the show. But I've learned a tremendous amount. In fact, this morning, one of my coworkers, I got this email saying that because you were going to be on the show, she was interested in hearing something about Japanese beetles because she's having a party.
Was that Don
DeBeer? It was Donna.
Yeah.
And I immediately fired off this response. It's like, oh, yeah, this and this and this and this and this. And then I had to apologize and said, look, I'm sorry. I've just done too many. I've done too many interviews. So so I hope I did okay in responding, but you really should be the one to respond. But basically, she said, where do they come from? And I said, well, they come from here.
They come from the ground.
They come from the ground. Yeah. I mean, they're here all around, and that the one of the other forms of them are the grubs that people hate that attack their lawn. And I said something like, you know, the thing about adult insects is they really only have pretty much one function besides eating your plants, and that is to make more of themselves.
And they're very good at that.
And they're very good at that. And I guess they have to be, because they're always being picked off by birds and other sorts of prey and humans.
Now, genealogically, if she'd meant, you know, where did they come from, then the answer would have been, actually, as the name suggests, Japan, because they weren't here before 1916. They were first reported in just actually south of the Statue of Liberty near Riverton, New Jersey. And they probably came clinging to the roots of nursery stock of trees, ornamentals that were brought in. So it's, again, one of the early wave of invasive immigrants. Immigrant discussions, that these you can't legislate out very effectively. But so they've been around for a very long time. I actually grew up in the Northeast, where they were resident for my entire childhood, which was a very long time ago. And so they only recently, in the last 15 or 20 years, moved into the Midwest. So we're just now getting to know them a little better.
Yeah. Was it that we joked about this, or that was actually true, that that the wing cases, this really actually very pretty, shimmery, metallic things, that people had used that to make jewelry?
Oh, of many beetles, particularly the Buprestid beetles. Absolutely. That was a craze in the late 19th century in Victorian England. The iridescent, in fact, it was such a craze, and the Victorians were so obsessed with the natural world that live insects were actually used as part of hats and dresses. So don't want to send those out for dry cleaning.
I would think people would have thought that was icky.
You would think, yeah.
Live insects.
It's insects in fashion. And another thing about that iridescent, sparkly, the metallic color has inspired innovations in automobile paint design. So the same sort of essentially nanotechnology that allows the metallic sheen of many beetle wings has inspired the development of new paints and other surface coverings. So, again, insects have inspired all kinds of things other than fear, loathing, and contempt. So,
well, and I'm sure that because they can, the Japanese beetle sages, for example, because they can be destructive, people would say, well, you know, how could you think that they were pretty? But I guess I kind of do I'd rather that they not eat my plants, but that they are kind of pretty.
In fact, one of my favorite things about them, and it's not unique to Japanese beetles, but it's just so apt that if you look at the last three segments of their antennae, they look like a Japanese fan. It's kind of, they're flattened and fan-like, so they look very Japanese.
You must have to look pretty close.
Well, yeah. In fact, I brought a basket of things. I wanted to put a hand lens in there for you for your future entomological exploits.
Oh, Watson, I'll have to come up with my own. We have some callers here who would like to talk with you. So enough of me. Let's talk with someone here in Urbana. This would be line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. We think of ants as being picnic pests, but there's a little beetle that was really bugging us.
Yep.
When we were sitting outside on our deck, and then we were eating outside at a downtown restaurant,
yep.
And it seemed to be attracted by the odor of the food. And I had known them years before, and were one of the reasons why I gave up on strawberries, because they, I think it's the same bug that was just tunneling into my strawberries. And I was really quite annoyed by these little guys. They didn't bite. They just kept landing on our stuff and in our stuff and on us and so forth. What are they?
Well, you might be not surprised to hear they're called picnic beetles.
Really?
In the family Nidoduliidae. They're also called sap beetles. And they are attracted to picnics, at least in part because they like spoiled things. Not fresh fruits as much as overripe fruit or anything fermented. So if you were having a beer with your picnic, that might have been particularly attractive. Or wine, that's right. So they like fermenting things. And they're very brightly colored and spotted. And they have, they are...
these are black.
Yeah, with any spots or just
yeah, little tiny spots,
little red, yeah,
tiny bugs.
Yeah, they are, and there are some economically important ones. There's a corn sap beetle that gets at the end of ears of corn, particularly any corn that's been already damaged by something else, and any kind of spoilage has set in. But they do like ethanol. One of the most obnoxious of the Nidoduliidae, the picnic beetles, is a pest actually of honeybee colonies. It's called the small hive beetle, and it's from Africa, accidentally introduced. And they like honey when it's spoiled, and the way the beetles fly in and will lay eggs, and the larvae will sort of tunnel their way through the honeycomb and by producing salivary excretions and other sorts of secretions, promote the fermentation of the honey, and it becomes a stinking mess, and it's their real annoyance. And they're established now in the state of Illinois, which is a shame. So bees don't like them any more than you like them.
So we should put something over the glass of beer or the glass of wine or drink them out of the bottle.
Yeah, drink them out of the bottle is probably your best bet. Beat the beetles to it.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go on here next to another caller, and that would be somebody, I believe, in line number four on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. This is your Belgium caller.
Oh, hi. Hi.
How are you? Yeah, I haven't been on quite as many times as Ms. Berenbaum, but I've listened for a long time, too. I've noticed that, you were mentioning things about bugs. There's a famous one that's used in the furniture industry, and it's called the lac beetle. Make shellac.
Yes. Yes, it is.
We still use it today, and it's a very good finish.
And
thing I was The thing I was going to bring up is this hot, dry weather has been pretty rough on the insects. You don't see near as many as I have seen at times, but last night or night before, I watched an orb spider build a nest, or web, pardon me, and watched him do his business while I drank a fermented beverage. And it was interesting to watch the way they do their deed,
which is
killing insects, which you don't like.
Well, I understand it. It's what the circle of life.
Yes.
Hakuna Matata. No, that's the wrong one. It's very hard to generalize about insects, and people are often saying, well, the dry summer must be hard on insects. Well, yes and no. There are a million species of insects, and they have a million different ways of making a living, so what's bad for one is likely very good for another. Spiders seem to be having a very decent summer. The house mosquitoes, Culex mosquitoes, you would think mosquitoes whose larval stages depend on water would actually be having a difficult time this summer because it's been so dry. But that's the case for the floodwater mosquitoes whose eggs don't hatch until the water rises. So they depend on rain in order to even have another generation. But Culex likes to breed in containers, natural or otherwise, and they like decaying. This is a day for decay, isn't it? That's not very appropriate in the last day of your, like what's next after this? They like rotting plant material. So as water levels drop in containers, like or tree holes, the decomposing mess becomes more concentrated, more attractive, and actually Culex are having a pretty good summer too. So the house mosquitoes, they're the sneaky ones that you can't feel when they bite you. The Aedes hurt. In fact, the most common Aedes here is Aedes vexans. So you can tell from its specific name, vexans, that it is an annoying beetle, a mosquito. But let me follow up on your, I'm so glad you mentioned the lac resin and you mentioned its use today. Well, I brought some for David. If you look at the ingredients of Nestle's Raisinets or Goobers, this is not an endorsement, but I'm not an official spokesperson. But if you read the ingredients, you'll see confectioner's glaze, parenthesis, lac resin. So this is often when you get candy, it says confectioner's glaze. That's sort of euphemistic for the glaze that is the shellac that is acquired from a sap-feeding Homopterus insect from in India and parts nearby, and it is very much an active industry. And I got you these candies with lac resin. So.
And you being a vegetarian, probably
nope.
You wouldn't eat that.
It was the saddest day of my professional career when I realized I could no longer eat raisinets and be a vegetarian.
It's interesting that. How do they make so many of those bugs to extract all that? They must have huge.
They do. In fact, the name lac for this insect derives from the Sanskrit equivalent, L-A-K-H, which means 100,000. And what these these insects form massive aggregations. They're kind of like woolly aphids or if you've ever seen mealybugs, they just coat the trees, and thousands and thousands of them, so much so that their excretion, the secretion they make, this resinous material, coalesces, and it basically coats the entire outside of the stem and bark of the tree. So, that an etymological note, that same root word, lac, L-A-K-H, is where we get the word lox from, which is smoked salmon. David is looking puzzled.
How could those two things have come together?
Because if you count the number of eggs a salmon produces,
it's a lot.
It's literally 100,000, but that's the origin. So,
all right.
But thank you for mentioning, because it lets me point out the theater candy here.
Thank you very much,
all right, thank you.
For a very enjoyable time.
Thank you. And actually, I was thinking about you not all that long ago, where there was the big dust-up at Starbucks.
Yes, for cochineal.
For cochineal. And the people were very unhappy who were vegetarians, who thought that the beverages, this particular beverage was vegetarian. And there was this insect-derived product that they were using as a coloring agent that they didn't they didn't know it was not labeled. And then when they suddenly found out that they had been ordering this thing that had this insect product in it, they were pretty unhappy about it.
Yeah, actually, again, I don't know if it's a euphemism or not, you see the word carmine or cochineal on a label. That's an insect-derived product, and technically speaking, that would make it not vegetarian. They've been used for a very long time. The red in the British redcoats was a cochineal dye. So.
And I would think that, too, actually, some people who would rather not have a chemical dye, you might think, well, that's a natural product.
100% biodegradable
rather,
and natural.
You rather have that, except if one is a vegetarian, well, you're not going to want to have that.
There's no way to process cochineal without killing the insect because it's actually a pigment that's produced inside the body of the female wax scale. So it's, they died in a noble cause. So.
Our guest this morning is May Barenbaum. She's the head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. We're talking about insects, not extermination, appreciation. She's done this with us for
30 years,
and we're glad to have her here this morning.
I should have given you a gift card to Starbucks.
Stop.
I forgot.
And she's also authored a number of really interesting books. So, by the way, if you're interested in, say, maybe reading about insects, you can head down to the bookstore and look for them. And I have here a copy. I think this is still the most recent, is it? Earwig's Tale?
Well, this one actually, the cookbook
is more recent. The honey cookbook,
But I have two books that I am way overdue on. If the head of U of I Press is listening, I'm working on it.
Right now she is. Yes.
Well, can I say one more thing?
Oh, yes, yes.
If, in fact, my visits to Focus 580 become fewer and farther between, I'd have to say it's so nice to have an opportunity to be I'm on a lot of talk shows nationwide, and nobody cares about anything except killing them, except for here. So I'm very grateful to them.
That's always from the very beginning.
Yep.
We have separated those two things. We realize that there are times when you say insects are causing a problem and we need to deal with them. We have a guy for that, our buddy Phil, who is also, he likes insects. We make this jokes about it's love the bugs, hate the bugs. He doesn't hate bugs. He loves bugs. But, sometimes you got to deal with them. But when May is here, we have always said, no.
I love ice cream, but I wouldn't want to find it on the pillow next to me in the morning.
Quite so. Well, other calls. Let's go to Savoy, line number two right here. Hello.
Hi, May. Maybe you could help me identify a critter.
Hope so.
I've got buzzing around some sort of hornet-looking things that are big, they're sort of thumb-sized, black and yellow stripes, like to live in the ground.
Well, they sound like cicada killers.
Yeah, I bet that's what they are.
Yeah, now the cicada killers are they are the largest eastern U.S. Wasp. They're a little early this year, and I think that's because the dog day cicadas are early this year. So they like the ground. They like sort of sandy soils optimally. I don't know if that's where you're finding them necessarily. Species speciosus. And they're, like the name suggests, they eat cicadas. They kill cicadas, which is a no mean feat if you look at the relative size of a cicada and a cicada killer. So they're basically bringing down an insect that can weigh more than they do, and they fly carrying these. They inject their venom, paralyze the cicada, and then transport it to the ground where they've dug out a nest, and they'll provision their hatching grubs with the still paralyzed living cicada, which keeps it from spoiling underground, but it's kind of a living, dead, zombie-like existence for the poor, gradually dying cicada. So, and if you ever hear you ever hear the cicada call and then it sort of trails off sometimes, it's probably a cicada killer.
Oh, and they're a form of wasp?
They are exactly that. They're wasps,
And they don't seem at all interested
nope.
in us.
No, it's kind of sad. They freak people out because they are territorial. The males will protect the burrows of the females in the ground. So if you happen to walk into their territory, they may sort of get in your face. The males will not sting you. They do not have stingers. Only the females do because the stinger is actually a modified egg-laying device. So no males have egg-laying devices, so they consequently don't have stingers. So they won't sting you. And the females are busy. They've got work to do, and they're hunting cicadas and burying them, and it's a lot of work. And to get stung by a cicada killer, you have to either step on them, which is hard to do because they are big and brightly colored, or, I don't know, perversely annoy them or tease them or call them names. They're, for the most part, pretty innocuous and awfully impressive entomologically, yet a lot of them just die because people want to get rid of them. So, because they are a little unsettling to see.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is one of the, I don't know how many times we've gotten this question, and that's one of the things that, because they're so big, they kind of freak people out. But the males, what they want to know is, are you another male cicada killer? And if once they've determined that you're not, they could not care less about you. They just want to chase off any other males that might be poaching on their territory.
Yeah, so all that macho posturing, you know what it gets them? You know, not a good idea, not a long-term strategy.
All right, take that, Mr. Darwin. let's see, Fisher is the next, line number three. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, first, I was going to ask you a question about tomato hornworms, but I wanted to ask you it now that you've talked about the cicada killers. I got to watch one once, but instead of taking the cicada to the ground, it actually climbed the tree, and it was amazing because it had this heavy weight, but, you know, it was like somebody climbing Mount Everest, it seemed to me. So they go up in the tree as well?
Well, what happens is because it's so hard to take off when you're carrying something that weighs more than you do, they climb up the tree to launch. So what they do is they'll climb up and then sort of launch themselves, flutter down, and then get some distance, and then find another object to climb, and then sort of free fall rather than fly per se. So, yeah, that's exactly what they were doing. She was just trying to get this home. It is incredibly difficult. I mean, people admire the lions and the cheetahs and the other animals.
We have a new hero.
Yeah, but if you can imagine, well, I guess lions do haul their, they don't haul their elephants up a tree, but it's really an amazing accomplishment.
Well, to the tomato hornworm, and since we won't talk about it's a terminating thing, what I'm looking for is how can I help convince people that just sort of making a blatant statement that they need to go and kill all these things is not the way to go, because they actually turn into something wonderful. And as I understand it, it's a nighttime pollinator.
It certainly is.
A valuable thing.
Yep.
And so I'm trying to do an education program for people, and I would certainly appreciate anything that could help me add to that.
Yeah. Yes, they do consume tomatoes. The tobacco hornworm and the tomato hornworm, two species of Manduca. They're in the sphingid family, and the common name is hawk moth. These two species are very closely associated with the tomato family, the Solanaceae. So they will also actually be found on solanaceous weeds, including horse nettle and jimson weed. So in that sense, not all the caterpillars are bad guys. Some of them are, from the human perspective, some of them are eating weeds. And then, just as you say, when they emerge as adults, they are hawk moths that can pollinate. And they are extraordinary pollinators because, like hummingbirds, they can hover. So they can pollinate a lot of flowers that have a lot of plants that have hanging flowers that are suspended. So other pollinators can't perch. The way the flower is constructed, it needs to be.
They don't have landing pads.
They do not have landing pads, so they need hoverers. Other than hummingbirds, hawk moths are the best thing out there for these plants. So,
are the hawk moths what we call hummingbird moths? Is that the same?
Yep. Yeah, and you see them around dusk, and then I've gotten a lot of calls about, why are there hummingbirds out in the right before nightfall? And they're not. Those are the moths. And they move a lot like hummingbirds. They're about the same size as hummingbirds. Some of them, like hummingbirds, even maintain their body heat, their body temperature. They have so much muscular action that they actually need to keep those muscles warm to keep them moving so quickly. So they're extraordinary in many ways. And
well, and I'm thinking we hear so much about, you know, with the bees and the trouble with the pollen that our regular pollinators are having, that it seems that we need to try and do everything we can to help other kinds of pollinators be able to help us out. And so maybe rethinking the tomato hornworm might be a good start.
Yeah, well, I'm sold. I think that's a good idea. You know, they will eat tobacco. And it's kind of an impressive feat, too, because nicotine is an insecticide. But these guys, you know how big they are. Tobacco clearly does not stunt their growth. So.
Does that have anything to do with, you know, with a hummingbird? You think of them as kind of zipping around all the time. Does the tobacco affect them and help?
Oh, hummingbirds aren't so much they're not growing up. You know, hummingbirds as babies feed on insects and then ultimately nectar. So they don't encounter the alkaloids, the toxins that are in plants in the tomato family. So was that what you're asking? Whether hummingbirds?
Well, actually, what I meant was the hummingbird moth that the tobacco moss, if they eat the nicotine in the tobacco, does that help them sort of be more
hyper?
Zippy like the hummingbirds are, since they're eating the sugar water? You know, they're all kind of flighty around.
Well, it's interesting. There have been studies on the effects of nicotine in the nectar of tobacco on tobacco hornworms and other pollinators, because tobacco plants don't just make nicotine in their leaves. They put nicotine in their nectar, which is kind of puzzling because nectar is supposed to be a reward for a pollinator. But why would you put a poison in your nectar? As it turns out, for the tobacco hornworm, it limits the amount of nectar it can consume from one flower. So it can't suck up all the nectar or else it'll get sick. So that encourages the tobacco hornworm moth to fly to another flower. And that way, the flower is manipulating the pollinator behavior, because that way the pollinator will visit another flower and transfer pollen. Honeybees, however, sometimes have a different reaction. They can actually get addicted to nicotine in nectar, which makes them visit tobacco flowers a lot. They can also, by the way, get addicted to caffeine. Bees are kind of scarily too much like us in many ways.
Amazing. You know, I never know what I'm going to learn here, but
oh.
I'm really grateful for the show. But thank you very much, May.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have some other calls here. I have a couple of emails we'll get in. We're talking this morning with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. We'll talk some more about insects after a short break. This is Focus.
After struggling with personal demons and being a mediocre pitcher for years, R.A. Dickey has mastered baseball's wackiest pitch, the knuckleball. He's now a dominating presence on the mound with an 11-1 record. On the next Fresh Air, Dickey tells us about dealing with child sexual abuse and turning his life around. His new memoir is Wherever I Wind Up. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, presenting Shakespeare's As You Like It, Othello, Comedy of Errors, and The Rivals by Richard Brinsley Sheridan from June 28th through August 11th at Ewing Manor in Bloomington. Ticket information is available at thefestival.org or 309-438-2535.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you listening in here. This is our last show, our last new show. I am retiring from the university, and I'm sorry about that. But we will, for at least a couple of months, be repeating some of our past programs. I think there are some good shows there, things that are worth hearing a second time. So actually, even though I won't be here Monday morning at 10 o'clock, if you tune in, I'll be here. The plan is that then in September, we'll start to do some new shows, and eventually there'll be a new person here hosting the program. And I certainly hope folks will continue to listen and support the station. But in the meantime, if you want to hear me, you can tune in at the regular time, or we have this vast web archive, and our webmaster, Jack Brighton, says he'd like to have that stay forever. So there are, I think there are some good things there that have a kind of timeless quality to them. So you can go sample the archive, and that way you can keep up on all the things that we're doing on the station on WILL AM, FM, and TV. So the website is WILL.illinois.edu. You can go there and find out what we're doing. You can also follow us on Twitter. You kids that do that wacky Twitter thing, WILL Public Media is where it is.
Actually, Can I actually tweet.
No.
I have the world's lamest Twitter feed. It's insect news. It's pathetically lame.
But you're at least in with the tweeting thing. I just don't get it.
Well, for example, myself, I don't get it. Today, if I weren't on the radio today, who else would I tell that at the San Diego Zoo this morning, their Lord Howe stick insect eggs hatched. This is an endangered walking stick phasmid, sometimes called the land lobster. It's it's about this big. Well, you can't see. Very large. It was thought to have gone extinct, and they're rearing them in captivity in the San Diego Zoo. And I was so excited to see that their eggs hatched. And there's baby land lobsters, baby Lord Howe stick insects. Now, who am I going to tell? I don't know. So anyway.
Other entomologists?
I tweeted.
You tweeted that. Okay.
And you know what? I wrote that they look just like their mother, but that's not surprising because they're hemimetabolous, and all hemimetabolous insects look like the adults. So anyway.
Okay. I want to thank the person, by the way, who sent in an email. I think May was really excited. Someone sent in because they heard us talking about insects as jewelry, sent in an email with a photo, and here are a couple of brooches that are decorated with Japanese beetles. It looks like intact,
yes,
whole Japanese beetles. And not, I think and they're actually pretty.
You shouldn't call them brooches, maybe beetles, right? Instead of brooches. Sorry about that.
Lowest form of humor. Yeah. Okay. And also, let me just do one other. This is, here's a picture I was just looking at because someone wrote in said they had seen this.
Yeah.
This is a sailback dinosaur bug.
Oh, well, they're also called wheel bugs, Aryllus. They have kind of made a resurgence here, too. Are members of the family Redivivi. They're called assassin bugs, and they do look like something that crawled out of the Jurassic.
They absolutely do, because they have this thing that does look indeed like it would be on the back of a dinosaur. And the person here wanted to know, they actually said they said that they managed to identify it and said that if they remembered right, that it wasn't an insect that was native here or doesn't. You don't find that often here?
No, they're native.
Oh, they are.
But they were never very common. I mean, I've been here 32 years, and only in the last 5 years or so have they been showing up regularly. Who knows? Global warming. They tend to be more southerly in their distribution, but they are being routinely encountered now. And they're predators. They attack mostly soft-bodied predators and suck the fluids out of them, you know, like caterpillars. But if you handle them and annoy them, they will not hesitate to inject their proteolytic salivary secretions into you, and it's painful.
So if you are a gardener, that you'd be happy to have these in your garden because they would be going after things that maybe you wouldn't want.
Right. They're beneficials in that sense.
Okay.
But they can inflict a painful bite.
All right. Well, let us continue. We'll talk with some more people who are listening here. Let me see who we'll be talking to. Wellington, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I'm sorry that you're leaving us. I hope that instead of having guest interviewees once a month, well, perhaps they could have you as a guest interviewer once a month. So we'll still get our little fix occasionally from you. But
I suggested that.
To you and your wife. As for May, I've noticed that, while I'm happy that we have very few Japanese beetles, I'm always like to see lightning bugs, and it doesn't seem like there are very many this year. Is that because it's been so dry?
Well, there was a wave of emergence of lightning bugs or fireflies in late May, which was, at least within my experience, extraordinarily early, and it was a lot wetter back then. Too. So hard to say definitively whether their relatively low abundance now is due to a lack of moist conditions, because as larvae, they feed on slugs and snails and other soft-bodied creatures that depend on high humidity, or whether they have one generation per year and it just showed up early this year. The strange weather we have and the increasing annual temperatures have created a kind of multiple mismatches between sometimes flowers and their pollinators, sometimes birds and the insects that they need for their fledglings. So it might just be the aberrant early spring wet conditions unleash the fireflies sooner than we expected them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I miss them, too.
Let's see. Next, we will come back here and talk with someone in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi. First, I'd like to say, David, how could you leave us?
We all got to go sometime.
Yeah, well, you're not going that way. And, you know, it's when I heard you were retiring, I heard that Celeste was already gone. So it's, what's that cat, Hector Henry? Your cat?
Our cat? Oh, our cat's yeah. Butch. His name is Butch.
Okay. Anyway, he's going to get a lot of attention.
Well, it's funny because he seemed to, right when she first retired, and so she was there during the day, he was with her for a lot of, but he got over it pretty quick. So now he's just taking a nap underneath something somewhere. So that wore off pretty fast.
Oh, it's like when the stay-at-home wife has her husband retire and he's underfoot all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, anyway, so I hope you will come back and guest interview every once in a while. And then, May, I took your class on bees at Ollie.
Ollie, uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it might be 4 years ago. I can't believe
it. I believe
that
that's right, yeah.
I think it was early 2008, and I was like, oh, no, it can't be that long ago. But I want to announce one and maybe two budding entomologists. They're my grandchildren in Chicago, and the 28-month-old is just obsessed with insects. His biggest occupation is to have his daddy turn over rocks and bricks. And my daughter-in-law suggested to her parents in suburban Chicago that they place bricks around the yard because they see them pretty regularly, so that he can just turn them over and find roly-polies. That's his big passion, is roly-polies. And I was at a family church camp with them last week, and my granddaughter, who will be 5 next month, lovingly carried around a, thankfully, dead Japanese beetle for some time, just, you know, inspecting it and admiring it, having no idea that the adults, you know, look with horror on Japanese beetles because they eat their host.
Everything.
So they usually don't kill them. Is that right?
Well, it depends. I mean, they have a host range of about 300 species. So some of their hosts can withstand the damage and some not so much. So
yeah, they used to get on my mother's roses in the
Detroit area. They love roses. They love grapes.
Yeah.
They are number on soybeans in central Illinois, actually.
Oh, so. And they like evening primrose. I've seen
them on Enothera, yeah. Uh-huh.
And what's the real name?
Oh, that's just the scientific name. But yes, that's one of their favorites.
What is it?
Oh, Enothera. It's O-E-N-E-R. Ena.
Oh, okay.
T-H-E-R-A.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this was in the 50s that they were in the Detroit area. So they are beautiful if you can get over their creepy crawly aspect. So anyway, so I don't think you'll still be here if my grandchildren come to the University of Illinois. But
I don't know. They're going to have to drag me out kicking. I cannot imagine. Retirement holds no attraction. I don't know what else I would do. I'm kind of a one-trick pony here, so I don't know. If I weren't an entomologist, I don't know what I would be.
Well, it'll probably be another 16 years before he graduates from high school, because he's just two. So,
oh, yeah, that's true.
He's certainly fascinated. The almost five-year-old, she starts school this year, so that'll only be another 12.
The next generation. And it's Enothera's 13. O-E-N-O-T-H-E-R-A, in case you were writing it, not writing it.
O-E-N-O-T-H-E-R?
Yeah, A, Enothera, yeah.
O-E-N-O-T-H-E-R-A. Oh, okay.
Enothera. Right. Uh-huh. That's the evening primrose.
All right. Thank you. Well, it's you know, you're lucky you got to go out on the last program. That's pretty special.
I am very honored. I can't tell you how honored I am. And I just, before I forget.
What?
Okay. Where is it? Here's a tie for you.
It's a tie.
It's a silk tie with grasshoppers.
A silk tie with grasshoppers. You're so sweet. Yeah, believe me. Yeah. May Barenbaum is here with us. We had about 10 minutes left. She brought a lovely a gift basket, lovely parting gifts. I'm sorry we have no home version of the show that I can give you. But the photos are pouring in. Our friend Lisa Braddock sent in this photo. She said that you might like it. This is a photo of a wheel bug with a dead Japanese beetle.
All right. Two topics right
pretty
there.
Cool.
Converging.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And she says, way out in Fisher, the corn and soybean fields are routinely covered in lightning bugs at dusk each night.
Oh, good.
Oh, that must be really outstanding. We're in past years, at least, we're, you know, I live in Urbana, and in my backyard, it's really dark, and it can be truly spectacular. We have a very tall, old black walnut in our backyard. It's even taller than our house, and sometimes you can see them. They're all the way up in that tree.
Well, I have colleagues from the West Coast. Well, we hosted the evolution meetings here in 2002, and one of the big attractions, what can you do? People host meetings in Colorado, and you go whitewater rafting. What did we do? We took people to see fireflies because there are no comparable emergences in the West Coast of fireflies or periodical cicadas.
Really?
And in the Smokies, actually, there are fireflies who flash synchronously, which is another really impressive one of the natural wonder how they sync up and manage to flash at the same time.
We'll try to get some more folks here. Don't know if we can get everybody. We'll try. I think actually next I should do. I took them out of order here. We'll go to Kankakee next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and
sure.
I'm sorry you're leaving, Mr. Inge. Dr. Barenbaum, I call you about my friends, the cicada killers, that humor my German short-haired pointer all summer for years and years. They're not back.
Ah.
Is that because the cicadas are cyclical?
Well, actually, they come out in time for the dog day cicadas. And the dog day cicadas are pretty, they're not the periodical cicadas. So periodical cicadas are the ones that come out 13 or 17 years. And they come out in spring, in May, at least around here. And they are very intermittent and localized. So we're on a 13-year cycle. Well, I guess the east of here, west of here, on the Sangamon. But and then in the there's another cycle for the 17-year on the East Coast. So, but the dog day cicadas have a 1 or 2 year developmental period and nymphal period, and they are pretty regular in.
They've always been coming out of the same hole, the same place.
Yeah, they're very site-specific, very loyal.
Looking for them.
Yeah, it's probably not sort of genetic memory as much as it is that certain places just have the right physical and biological requirements so that they tend to recolonize. But yeah, you get them the year after year in the same place, but it's still a little early. They may still turn up.
Okay, so I just have to be more patient.
I think, this is early for cicada killers. Usually it's, the dog day cicadas. Dog days are in August, so in theory, or they're sometimes called harvest flies. They're not real flies, but they're called harvest flies because they come out with the harvest, and nobody is harvesting yet in June. So more July and August.
Okay.
So I hope you get to see them.
I hope to come back. They're a great joy for me and a great joy for her.
Great. Wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the call.
Thanks for calling. Back here to Urbana for a caller. Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to start by thanking you, David. It's been a great program.
Well, thanks.
And I have a question for May.
Mm-hmm.
Photography with insects. I'm planning to get extension tubes, and I thought that I'd use them it's a single-lens camera, single-lens reflex. I thought I might use an 80-millimeter lens with a short extension tube. Or I could use a 300-millimeter lens with probably the same extension tubes. Does that sound like a reasonable way to go for photographing insects?
What I will do is refer you to arguably one of the world's best insect photographers who lives right in town. And his name is Alex Wild. If you go to alexwild.com, I think, he is an incredibly talented, amazingly gifted insect photographer and entomologist. He specializes in ants. And he actually teaches courses and also takes private students. And he tweets and he blogs. Myrmecos is the name of his blog, which is means ant, M-Y-R-M-E-C-O-S.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any questions about equipment, Alex can take a picture with an iPhone and a hand lens that is better than any picture I've ever taken in my entire life with thousands of dollars worth of equipment. So if you can try getting in touch with Alex, and I'm sure he can give you pointers. Just his pictures are breathtaking. So it's worth just visiting his website to see what you can accomplish with a camera and some insects.
Well, I'll certainly do that. It's Alex Wild.
Yeah, A-L-E-X, Alex, and then Wild, W-I-L-D.
And it's a .com. I'm looking at it right now, and it's a really beautiful. You'd figure he's an artist. It's a really beautiful website. And it does talk about here how, he gives personalized one-on-one instruction. He does group workshops. He does short presentations. And you can see some of his
And he also does systematics of ants. So he's trained as an entomologist.
And in fact, here, right, is a picture. Isn't that the insect that we were talking about? The dinosaur thing?
Wheelbug.
Yeah, okay,
there
right
is.
There. All right, yes. Alex Wild, just like it would sound, .com.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll keep going. And next, I think we'll talk with someone in Paris. Line one. Hello. Champagne, line one, oh. I think. Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Yes,
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah. In terms of, ants with the weather, it doesn't seem like as big a problem this year or something or other. Is that true or not?
Again, it's really hard to say. Ants usually make their presence known in the spring because they are hungry. They come out, they overwinter. Their colonies are, active all winter, but at a low level. And then when they come out, if the flowers haven't bloomed yet, they're less plant material to eat, less insect biomass out there, and they'll come into houses, and that's why people notice them. But this, we didn't have a particularly late spring in terms of insect emergence. In fact, a lot of things were early, so ants didn't appear to be quite as pestiferous as usual. They didn't need to raid houses to get enough to eat. So it's hard to say whether or not they're more or less common. And again, there are dozens of ant species in the neighborhood. So where some may be up, others might be down. So globally, I'm not sure there's, or at least regionally, I'm not sure there's a discernible trend. There are certainly active ants this time of year, though.
And then also spiders. It seems like for some reason, I don't know, maybe they've been telling their friends, but it seems like I've had a few more spiders this year.
Yes, I mean, that's an observation many people have made to me already.
Oh.
Hard to say why. That one's anybody's guess at this point.
Well, it's nice to share the pain.
Yeah.
actually, with David, I'm wondering, Paradiso, whether they're going to have a chair there for you?
Yes, they should. After all of the coffees that I have had there, yes, they should.
Right.
A little plaque right on the back.
Or they can just line up the coffee cups up to the ceiling and create a chair maybe for you.
Oh, excellent! Good thought.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, thanks very much. I got an email here. I just wanted to mention that you might want to say a couple of things. This is from the person who sent the pictures of the Japanese beetle jewelry. She says the current favorite garden bug for her these days is the leafcutter bee. She said, mm-hmm. I've always been intrigued by the moon holes at the edge of her epimedium and never knew what made them. And then a cunning little cigarette-shaped object made of beautiful overlapping pieces of leaves fell out of my window frame when I was washing windows. Someone in McLean County Master Gardeners identified the egg case for me and told me it was the same insect that made those holes in my epimedium. And she's apparently can live with that. The damage is minimal in the garden.
Yeah, their industry is really remarkable. Precision with which they cut megachilid bees are the so-called leafcutter bees. There's a small and large leafcutter, and they make correspondingly smaller or bigger moons out of favored host plants. So Thanks for admiring them.
All right. I think we are pretty much at the point we're going to have to finish. I don't know if we can get one more caller. Maybe we'll try Decatur line 3. Hello? Is there a caller there on line 3? Okay, maybe not. Well, I'm sorry if I got things goofed up there at the end.
Well, that gives me a chance to say I wasn't supposed to say anything.
Well, we weren't really expecting you. Yeah. Well, also, we didn't expect the lovely gift basket either.
Because we talked about Insect Fear Film Festival, I brought one of our Insect Fear Films and an Insect Fear Film Festival T-shirt. Oh, these, don't miss these. These are chocolate bees and chocolate...
Now, they aren't really...
ladybugs.
Really bees and ladybugs.
But I have to point out, of course, chocolate exists because of the pollinating activities of ceratobogonid flies.
Well, where would we be without pollinators?
Where would we be without
where
insects?
Where would we be without bees? And it's interesting, because it was not a long ago, I talked with your buddy E.O. Wilson, who has written a new book that's, mm-hmm. I guess, got the biology world kind of roiled up, because he really makes this argument, you know, I hope I haven't hashed it up too much, where I've said that, you know, the argument always was that living things, they only really want to do one thing. They want to see their genetic material passed forward. So that's why people will do anything to guarantee the survival of their children or possibly of their siblings' children. Mm-hmm. He said the thing about humans and also insects,
yep.
bees,
yep.
ants,
social insects.
Maybe termites, the social insects, for them, they will do that for individuals that are not related to them. And that might, you know, I think he would make the argument, you know, for good or ill as far as human beings are concerned, that maybe that's what it is. That's one of the things that was important to our survival, because we're groupers, and that because we band together cooperatively in groups, and that we'll do stuff for our neighbors, even though they're not related to us. And that's one of those things where, yes, us and the bees are really very close.
And how many people how many tens of thousands of people? Well, times 30 years. So
maybe.
So, how bee-like of you.
How bee-like of me. Well, it's sweet of you to say that. So nice to have you here for the last show.
Oh, and let me just say, there is a genus of spider. We've talked about on the show in the past, and they're cobweb. They live in sort of cobwebs and corners, and their name is Fulcus. And I always thought that if you ever wanted an endorsement for the show, or a sponsorship, you could call it Fulcus 580.
And pity that spiders just creep me out.
Oh, they're not insects, right?
Oh, that's right. That's the end. That's it. We're done. To everybody who said nice things about me and the show over the years, thank you so very much. Without you, there'd be no point. That's it, our last show. But if you tune on Monday, I'll be here. We'll be here for a while, and hopefully the archives will last forever. So you want to go back and hear some past shows, you can do that.